From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Federal offices in Washington are closed today because of that snowstorm hitting parts of the country. But neither snow nor sleet nor rain can keep us from politics.
So let's bring in our political strategist, Matt Mikowiak. Republican strategist is in Austin, where there is no snow, right, Matt? Today?
That's right.
Okay, good. And Jamal Simmons, Democrat and host at Hill TV. He is in Washington. Hi, Jamal.
Hi. I slogged through the snow to get here here for you guys.
Good. City's at a standstill.
We're glad. So we're going to get to 20.
All my kudos.
We're going to get to 2020 in a few minutes because there's a lot to talk about right there. But let's talk about first about what the White House is up to right now. California Governor Gavin Newsom is accusing President Trump of political retribution for demanding that that state return money for the high-speed train that Newsom has partially put on hold. Newsom said the Trump administration demanded the money after the state sued the administration for declaring a national emergency to fund the border wall. And yesterday, President Trump predicted a legal victory in the courts.
And I think we'll do very well. We have absolute right to do that. I have an absolute right to call national security. We need strong borders.
Matt, first of all, how do you feel as a Republican about Trump doing this, declaring a national emergency in this way? And do you think that it is retribution against California?
No, I don't think it's retribution against California. I think they're trying to get federal taxpayer dollars back for a project that was canceled. Obviously, the dollars were sent to California for that project. And so since the project's not moving forward, presumably they'd have a right to get some of that back. Look, the National Emergency Declaration, it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. Obviously, it's going to move into the courts. It's not going to be resolved anytime soon. It's going to take a year or 2 years. I actually think on the merits that you can make a pretty strong argument that there is a crisis on the border. I know that that's a big debate. But the fact that we've already taken in the first 4 months of this year almost as many unaccompanied minor children and family units as we did all of last year tells you that we do have a crisis down there. It's not simply the number. It's the type of people that are coming in. We do not have the bed space and the facilities to handle and process these individuals. And so, we're not asking for a border across the entire southern border. We're asking for it in the urban areas. That's what the Border Patrol and experts down on the border believe is necessary. Obviously, there are constitutional concerns. I think in this case, the National Emergencies Act allows for the president to take this step. You've had, I think, 58 or 59 national emergencies declared since 1976. Over 30 of them are still in effect, and not once has the Supreme Court overturned it. Now, obviously, the difference here is that he's moving money around, and Congress has, obviously, the power of the purse. And so that's going to be the legal question going forward.
Jamal?
It may or may not be a crisis. It certainly is not an emergency. The president of the United States has been threatening this and talking about this impending doom that's coming across the border, mostly from brown people who are coming across the border. Let's not forget that. There is no emergency. There is no emergency. The president, even when he said he was declaring an emergency, said, I don't have to do this. Now, let's add this other point. Of course, then he also went to play golf at his golf club after he said it was going to be an emergency, which does not smell of an emergency. And lastly, I'll just say the president of the United States is declaring an emergency for something that he tried to get funding for through the appropriate means in Congress and was denied. It is this is the first time by any reckoning I've heard that a president has tried to do such a thing.
That has never happened before. Well, I want to switch to Andrew McCabe, who has been everywhere. This is the former acting FBI director. He's been pushing back with a new book on President Trump's attempts to discredit Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation. And here he is on CNN last night with Anderson Cooper.
Do you still believe the president could be a Russian asset?
I think it's possible. I think that's why we started our investigation. And I'm really anxious to see where Director Mueller concludes that.
To which later, White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway responded.
It's hardly worth dignifying with a response. He's a known liar and leaker, and he has said, gee, I guess it's possible, but I can't say that as a fact. Then why the heck are we talking about it?
Well, Jamal, I want to take this up with you, but you have to give me a second because I have to sort of lay some groundwork here because this is so complicated and netty. And conservative Federalist Society contributor Margot Cleveland is saying the same thing. McCabe is a liar and he's getting free network airtime to get out in front of potential criminal charges he might face from President Trump's new Attorney General, William Barr. And briefly to summarize, McCabe is accused of lying, including under oath, and two other federal agents about leaking to the Wall Street Journal parts of the FBI's investigation into the Clinton Foundation during the campaign. McCabe says a justice official tried to discourage him from doing the investigation during the campaign. He was also being questioned about whether he could be impartial and have an investigation because his wife received money from a Clinton friend in a campaign his wife was in. And people speculate maybe McCabe was trying to prove he could be impartial and investigate Clinton and let the Wall Street Journal know that. But putting that aside, he's accused of lying about leaks. So, Jamal, we land on the question. Are people correct? Why believe McCabe about Trump?
Why believe Trump about anything? Donald Trump, according
to
the
Washington
Post.
You were a lot quicker than I was in getting to that point. But, yeah.
The Donald Trump, the president of the United States, according to the Washington Post, has been caught lying thousands of times.
Yeah, but do you know what your mother used to say? Just because he did it. Just because he did it. I mean, is the press giving too much to McCabe?
The president admitted that he misled the New York Times when they were talking about a meeting with Russians and he drafted a straight statement with his son. He said, oh, it's just the failing New York Times. Why does that matter? The president is an admitted prevaricator. So the question becomes, you have all these people, not just Andy McCabe. You have former directors of the CIA, former national security officials. You have the former director of the FBI. There are a series of people whose job it is to catch spies and to protect the United States from foreign threats who have all said in public, in ways that are remarkable because they don't usually talk in public, that the president of the United States is either in league with or being is certainly in league with and is certainly acting in the interest of a foreign power that is an adversary of the United States. And so when an unreasonable thing like this, a fantastic thing like this occurs, reasonable people are thinking about doing things that sound unreasonable because they're faced with a provocation that they have to do something. And they're not doing it outside the law. They're doing this inside the confines of the law. So okay. I find this to be, we are focused on the wrong thing. It's not Andy McCabe. It is the fact that we have Donald Trump who is provoking these people into doing these things.
Okay, now we need to focus on 2020 because there's a lot to talk about. And Matt, even though it's the Democrats who are making the news, I'm going to start with you. And the question is, Bernie Sanders, he's in the race. $6 million he raised in 24 hours or so, much more than Kamala Harris raised in her first day of fundraising. What do you think of his entry into the race, Matt, or what do you think of the Democratic field at this point?
Yeah, I mean, you can make an argument that Bernie Sanders has already won the Democratic primary in the sense that all the candidates are running on his ideas. Mm-hmm. You know, he ran last time against the Democratic establishment and I think succeeded in many ways because he wasn't Hillary Clinton. He ran with a better message. He ran a better campaign. And were it not for the superdelegates, he may have been the nominee ultimately. He appeared to be, you know, pretty unsure about whether he wanted to run this time. And obviously, you're going to have a very large field. You have 10 or 11 people running now. There are a few more that will get in, sitting senators, likely at least one governor, some private sector folks probably.
Vice President.
Yeah, former Vice President Joe Biden, who at least in the polling is the front runner. Look, to me, the way I'm trying to think about the Democratic primary is this about purity or is it about electability? And I know that there's been some polling recently that's made it clear that maybe it's about electability. It seems like the energy is really more on the purity side, who can really be perfectly aligned with the Democratic left and progressivism on the issues. And I think that obviously pushes the potential Democratic nominee further from the middle, which makes it more and more likely that Trump could potentially get reelected.
Well, Jamal, what do you think about that? And I want to, before I hear your answer, I want to hear what Amy Klobuchar, because this kind of gets to this point, what she said in a CNN town hall on Monday night when she was being asked about free four-year college for all. Here she is.
I am not for free four-year college for all. No. Thank you. And I wish if I was a magic genie and could give that to everyone and we could afford it, I would.
So what do you think, Jamal, about the issue of electability versus purity on the Democratic side?
Electability has never impassioned anyone in an election. I got to say, I've been through a lot of elections. And what wins elections is passion. What wins elections are people who have a fervor for the candidate and they want to see them get to the Oval Office more than they want anything else that's happening out there. And I think when Democrats try to pick a candidate that they think some mythical swing voter somewhere in America is going to like, we end up with a campaign like a Great Patriot, but a campaign like John Kerry's in 2000. 2004, which Democrats weren't even very excited about, and so neither were other people.
Yeah. Matt,
I think the people who are out there who are the ones exciting real passion and energy are the ones who stand the best chance of getting elected.
But Matt, we've had already a debate amongst the candidates about who is a socialist and what that means. I mean, Bernie Sanders embracing the fact that he's a Democratic socialist, has been all his life. Kamala Harris having to backtrack and say, I'm not a Democratic socialist. Most Americans don't really, you know, the definition or can distinguish between, you know, a Marxist socialist or a Democratic socialist who is for a democracy. Do you think that Republicans are going to take this and run with it? Or is it to their detriment, ultimately, if people understand, wait a second, maybe fixing health care with Medicare for all is a good thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think the word socialism still scares people, and it should. And we're seeing, obviously, a terrible example of its failure in Venezuela, which is obviously on the extreme end of the spectrum. But it is a present-day example of that. And so I do think that it's a helpful contrast. The president campaigned. He did that in the State of the Union. He did that in his rally in El Paso. I think he'll do that over the next 2 years.
You have to jump in to say it's not only an extreme example. It's not the same thing, you know, by definition. It's not a democracy. But we take your
point.
Well,
sure. I mean, yep. But controlling the means of production is the definition of socialism, and Venezuela's done
that. Who's arguing for that?
Who's
arguing to control the means of production? We're arguing to make sure people have health care and they get to school.
Have to work on that message. We're going to have to end it. Jamal Simmons, Democrat. Matt Mikowiak, the Republican. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All this week, we're talking about places that have made significant progress reducing homelessness. Bergen County in northern New Jersey is one. It's across the Hudson River from New York City and is the most populous county in that state. And it was recognized by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development as the first community in the country to end chronic homelessness back in 2017. Joining us now is Julia Orlando, who's the director of the Bergen County Housing, Health, and Human Services Center in Hackensack, New Jersey. Julia, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And first of all, just tell us a little bit about Bergen County. Describe the homelessness problem as it existed about 10 years ago.
So here in Bergen County, we're a very large community. We're just about under a million people. About 10 years ago, we were really focused in on a growing chronic homeless population. At that time, we also had 4 temporary shelters that were really inadequate. And so in 2007, we began focus groups with about 200 community participants to really analyze the shortfalls and the barriers to our existing system.
And when you say you've got about a million people living there in Bergen County, how many people were chronically homeless at that time?
So it was estimated that it was several hundred people. Over the past decade that I've been doing this work, the definition of chronic homelessness has changed over time. And we found that once we really were meeting with people one-on-one and analyzing the needs, that number was higher.
So what did you do to bring the number down?
So one of the key parts of our 10-year plan was to develop the Housing, Health, and Human Services Center. By having one facility in this suburban area to provide meals, to provide housing, to provide services in one location, we were able to better address the needs of a chronically homeless person rather than having to have them transverse through the entire county of Bergen. We provided a location that was a one-stop center where that individual could get all of the services that they needed, and that really served to be, I think, a turning point in our work.
Was it difficult to get some of the homeless people to come to that location?
You know, what's interesting is I think when you're doing this work, there's always the belief that people will be resistant to shelter. And if you create a space that is welcoming and it's, you know, there's low barriers to getting into the facility, people will come in for services. And I think that's really very important, is you want the space that you're working in to be welcoming so that people will not be afraid to come in. They're not going to be afraid that they're going to have to also give up their belongings. And that's a very important piece when you're working with chronically homeless individuals.
So that's a place that they can come for services. What about for shelter at night? Where do they sleep?
So it's all in the same facility. Mm-hmm. So we have 90 beds of shelter. We also have capacity for another 30. So the way that the facility is designed is you can be in the same place to sleep, in the same place for all three meals of the day, and in the same place for all of the services.
And what about getting them permanent housing?
So the Housing Authority of Bergen County oversees all of the programming for the facility. And so there is access to vouchers, there's access to housing, as the Housing Authority of Bergen County has a 20% set aside of their affordable housing, of their vouchers for this facility. And by prioritizing access for homeless individuals, people are not just entering our system, but they're also exiting to permanent housing.
And what has been the biggest challenge there? Because that is the issue that so many communities around the country deal with, is to get people who are chronically homeless into permanent housing so that they're not having to live in a temporary shelter.
The challenges, I think, for us is in many places that you'll see around the country is, of course, getting access to landlords that will work with you, making sure that apartments will accept a subsidy, will accept a person that has a chronicity. So what we have established with our partners is a relationship with landlords to make sure that those landlords know that they're going to get paid every month. They know that if there's any kinds of issues, there's going to be someone there to talk to. We don't just, you know, end our relationship with the person when they leave and go to permanent housing. We maintain that relationship. And so together, we really become a safety net for that person to make sure that not only are they going to permanent housing, but that they're also succeeding in permanent housing.
What are you doing to prevent people and families from becoming homeless in the first place?
So I think that that's very important. And the center also provides eviction prevention. If someone is about to be evicted, we can actually stop that process by providing back rent to the person. We can also provide first month's rent and security to the person to get them into something that's more affordable. You know, we're also supporting and encouraging expansion of affordable housing. If people can access affordable housing, that they can, you know, with a livable wage, and we can stop some of that food insecurity, that we can help people to continue to stay in their homes.
So I imagine that one of the questions that people have as they're listening to you talk about some of these solutions that have worked for you in Bergen County is, how much does all of this cost? How does it get paid for, all of these programs you're talking about?
Absolutely. And I think what's really important is when people come to look at our facility, they'll say, well, you know, it would be very expensive for us to build this building. And what we say to people is, it's really not having a huge, large facility to do all this. It's really the kind of work that you're doing. And I think the key to Bergen County is our collaboration. It's working with all of our partners together, where everyone has the same goal. The other thing that's really been helpful for us is to have our county trust fund, having a homeless county trust fund to fill in the gaps when you need services and really there's nothing else to pay for a certain thing that you need, has been tremendously helpful.
So when you look around the country and you see other places that are still dealing with large numbers of people who are chronically homeless, what is the first thing that you tell them that they ought to do what you've done?
I think the most important thing is to have a goal. If your goal is to end chronic homelessness, then the thing that you need to do is you need to make sure you're prioritizing those folks. And you're going to need everyone on the same page. It's very difficult for people to understand at first the benefits of housing your most vulnerable in your community. But when I look at a place like Hackensack, New Jersey, once we really eliminated chronic homelessness, people no longer saw people sleeping on a bench or in a park. The quality of life for people has really improved. And I think when you do that, then you can focus on all of your other priority populations of homelessness. So for example, now that we've ended chronic homelessness, people who are experiencing homelessness for the first time, it can be rare, it can be brief, and it can be non-recurring, because we can focus our efforts on those individuals, making sure that they don't become chronic homeless because they're waiting for an intervention.
Julia, what is the biggest challenge you still have there when it comes to dealing with the homeless in Bergen County?
So right now, a big focus for us is our aging baby boomers. We have a large percentage of individuals who are aging and have medical challenges and who also have lived here, you know, probably their whole lives. It's very difficult for them to perhaps accept the fact that perhaps living alone without support is not a realistic thing. And so we're working very hard right now with hospitals, local hospitals, to really make sure that if people are going to be, you know, aging in place or living longer, that we're making sure that those services are not only accessible, but also affordable. And so that's the big focus for us. In addition, on the other spectrum is our young adults, our 18 to 24 year olds. We have a young adult task force. We also have a youth council made up of currently homeless young people to help guide us in what the needs are of young people. Because what we're seeing with them is young people can be staying in an apartment with a friend and couch surfing, yet they don't see themselves as homeless. So what an older person looks at and what a younger person looks at as homeless and their needs are completely different.
But you're saying with young people, they may actually be staying somewhere. They may be living under a roof, but you would consider them homeless.
For a lot of them, it might be that they are staying in someone's apartment or staying with a friend's house a couple nights here, a couple nights there. So is that stably housed? Is that permanently housed? And the answer is no. So what we're really making sure is, are they safe? Are they going to school? We have to recognize that all youth are vulnerable, because we know that for every day that a young adult is homeless, there's a 2% chance that when we house them, you know, into someplace safe, that they're going to return to homelessness. The essence of the work is on urgency. So many of our young adults are exploited and can be in situations that are really precarious. And so we want to make sure that we're doing really good assessments with them and offering them really safe places to stay.
That is Julia Orlando, who is director of the Bergen County Housing, Health, and Human Services Center in Hackensack, New Jersey. Bergen County was the first in the country to end chronic homelessness. Julia, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on the program today.
And tomorrow, our series continues in Chicago, where some hospitals are treating homelessness as a health condition, providing housing for chronically homeless patients.
Here and Now is supported by LegalZoom, who wants you to know that if you want to make 2019 the year you finally start a business or secure your family's future, LegalZoom can help. With their network of independent attorneys licensed in all 50 states, LegalZoom can help you navigate your legal needs, from wills and trusts to LLCs, trademarks, contract reviews, and more. And the best part is, LegalZoom is not a law firm, so they don't charge by the hour. More at LegalZoom.com/now.
The European aircraft manufacturer Airbus has announced that it will end production of the world's largest passenger plane in 2021. The decision came after Emirates Airlines, that's the biggest customer of the A380, reduced an outstanding order for 53 of the planes to just 14. For more, let's go to Seth Kaplan, editor of Airline Weekly. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
And this plane is a very big one. It's a double-decker. It's 555 seats. It was considered a high-tech marvel when it was rolled out in 2005. Why don't airlines want to buy this plane?
Well, the answer to that question is not because passengers don't like it. You know, from that perspective, it's actually been very successful. I mean, I was on one once. I was just in a regular economy seat. And it was a smooth, quiet ride, you know, this really big plane just kind of floating through the sky. And everybody I've ever talked to likes flying it. The problem is that the math just hasn't worked out for airlines in terms of the money. And, you know, Airbus thought they'd sell many of these, over 1,000. Turned out that airlines didn't want really big planes to fly really long distances, because the farther you fly, actually, the fewer people want to fly in most cases. So, you know, Boeing came out with a plane, the 787 Dreamliner, which could fly really long distances but was a lot smaller. And it turned out that that's what airlines wanted. Airbus came out with a competitor to that too, which has been rather successful.
So what kind of planes, for example, will Emirates decide to buy instead of the A380?
Well, they're going to buy some more planes from Airbus, but planes, well, the kinds that you see more often out there, you know, A350s, A330s, these kinds of planes. So those are twin aisle, or what you call wide body planes, planes that can, you know, fly across oceans, fly long distances, but they just don't have as many seats to fill. And Jeremy, they only have two engines, not four. That was a part of the problem. Nowadays with engine technology, you can fly a really long way on just two engines. So in that regard, too, the A380 with four engines, four fuel-guzzling engines, was kind of obsolete by the time it started flying.
And what about Boeing? The I guess, competitor, although it's still much smaller than the A380, would be the Boeing 747-8. How has that plane avoided extinction?
Well, it's doing even worse than the A380, quite honestly. Boeing hasn't even sold as many of those. What happened was when Airbus came out with the A380 and you know, thought that there was all this demand for these planes, Boeing didn't necessarily agree, but it kind of hedged its bets. It didn't build an all-new airplane like the A380. It updated the 747, as you said, called it the 747-8, and it sold terribly. You know, one of these days, I think we'll get a similar announcement from Boeing. The difference is that it's not nearly as much of a problem for Boeing because Boeing didn't invest nearly much. They just updated an old plane rather than spending tens of billions of dollars on an all new plane that then became a dud.
So Airbus is ending production of the A380, but later this year they are going to welcome the Beluga XL plane, which looks like a whale. It's just a cargo plane, yeah, so we won't be able to fly on it, but it's even bigger than the A380.
It is, and you're right. There's a reason they call it the Beluga. If you've never seen it, check it out. Yeah, one of those things that aviation geeks, as they call themselves, hey, as we call ourselves, right, mm-hmm. Jeremy, would love to fly.
That is Seth Kaplan of Airline Weekly, and we will post a picture of the Beluga XL at hereandnow.org. Seth, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
So which Democratic Party will win the Democratic Party's presidential nomination? Senator Kamala Harris says she is not a Democratic socialist, though she's called for Medicare for all. Bernie Sanders proudly says he is one. He's proposed making college free for those who can't afford it. Same with Senator Elizabeth Warren. But Senator Amy Klobuchar says she's not a genie. She can't promise that. Progressive or centrist? Every Democratic candidate will be asked where they stand. In our ongoing conversations with the candidates of all parties, we're joined today by Julian Castro, former mayor of San Antonio, who also served as Secretary of Housing and Urban Development under President Obama. He's hoping to be the first Latino president of the United States. Secretary Castro, Julian, welcome.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And so, where do you stand? You know, are you for expanding Medicare now just for seniors to all? Bernie Sanders has a bill before Congress that would create a single-payer system, essentially eliminate almost all private insurance. Are you down with that?
Yeah, well, what I believe we need to do is to be the smartest, the healthiest, the fairest, and the most prosperous nation on earth. So in order to become the healthiest nation on earth, we need a different healthcare system. You know, I grew up with a grandmother who had diabetes, and as her condition got worse and worse, we were very fortunate that she had Medicare. I believe that Medicare should be there for everybody.
But how do you pay for it?
That's a great question, and we're going to have to find different ways, different revenue streams to pay for it, including looking at raising the top marginal tax rate, mm-hmm. raising taxes on people that are making more than $1 million. I think that we need to ask people at the top to pay their fair share.
Well, staying with Medicare for just a second, because it's instructive. Vox is reporting that even Democrats who signed on to Bernie Sanders' bill before Congress about, you know, Medicare for all have balked at its core feature of eliminating private insurance. Kamala Harris had to come back after saying who needs insurance and say, well, there would be some private insurance. Cory Booker, who's also a presidential candidate, says he's not in favor of completely eliminating private insurance. I don't want to ask you about that specifically, but what do you think about this fight you know, you've got the flamethrowers in Senator Warren, who just wants to sees this as a moment to take apart government. You've got Kamala Harris, who's trying to move herself more towards the center and say it's a time to bring back our faith in the institutions as they are. Do you think this is healthy?
Yeah, well, first, Robin, I'm actually interested in answering the question that
about
think people
insurance?
Should know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And then let's get on to the political question. But first, to me, what I believe is that everybody should have the ability to enroll in Medicare. If somebody wants a supplemental plan or a private plan, then I believe they should be able to do that as well. On the political end, I'm not going to get caught up in the back and forth. You know, I believe in my own vision for the future of the country that is based on what families need to thrive. More education than ever, because jobs require more skill and knowledge than ever before. They need health care. They need a justice system that is fair, no matter the color of their skin or their sexual orientation. That's what I'm going to focus on during the course of this campaign.
Look, I have to ask you, because you mentioned your grandmother, I want to talk about two things you talk about a lot, your Mexican background and your faith. They almost seem entwined. Your grandmother came to the U.S. to live with a relative when she was an orphan. Your mom, single mom, an activist. You and your twin brother, Joaquin, who serves in the 20th Congressional District in Texas, met the Pope. You know, from your grandmother's journey here as an orphan to two generations later meeting the Pope, an American story. But it comes at a time when some Americans don't trust that story as much. How do you convince those Americans who might be concerned about the first Latino president that maybe you won't be for a secure border? How do you approach them?
That what I share in common with so many Americans is the blessing of this country, that my grandmother was able to come here when she was 7 years old as an orphan and worked as a maid, a cook, and a babysitter, raised my mom as a single parent. We've lived this immigrant American dream experience. I share the belief that this country can continue to produce that kind of American dream. To answer your question, of course, I believe in a secure border, but I think that we can achieve border security and also not lose who we are, that we can be compassionate toward people.
Look, you have been one of the party's rising stars at different times now in the recent past as a young mayor of San Antonio with your keynote speech in the 2012 convention.
I don't know, Robin, if I'm supposed to feel young or old these days. You know, right. I read half the articles and I'm a young guy, and then the other half I'm a has-been.
Right. So, you know, his star rose and fell. In 2012 convention keynote speech was riveting to many people. But you've also had your critics. And this is when you were in the Obama administration at HUD. You were severely attacked. Now, there was a political bent to some of this because a lot of these groups did not want to see you be Hillary Clinton's running mate because they were backing Bernie Sanders. But still, there were accusations that at HUD, we know that after the housing crisis, there were several homes heading towards foreclosure. They were going to be put up for sale. There were a lot of groups advocating for low-income people to get those homes. You were accused of selling most of them to Wall Street. In fact, a letter was sent to you by Raul Grijalva, co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus at the time. And he wrote, "Your distressed asset stabilization program designed to help right the wrongs of the meltdown years has been selling homes that once belonged to families I've spoken with at rock bottom prices to the Wall Street entities that created the situation." You were accused of turning your back on the very people you say you support, people of color and low income.
Yeah, it was a very odd attack back then. It came in the middle of the vice presidential selection process. And that program that they talked about had been around before I got to HUD. And I was actually the one that came in and said, we're going to change this. We're going to improve the program. And we did improve the program. So I just saw it as kind of an off-base, attempt by some individuals and some groups to score some political points. The other thing is that coalition, Color of Change, that was one of the organizations that had signed on to it, actually took their name off of that attack once they understood what we were already working on.
Well, you had your supporters at the time. Lori Goodman of the Urban Institute said, you know, people didn't understand the pragmatic realities that the mortgages had to be gotten out of HUD so that HUD could use its resources for those very people who needed help because these mortgages were so bad. And you had to find buyers big enough to take them off HUD's hands. So you did have your backers. And you have others who point out the very many progressive things you've done. And that's why I want to ask you about your Catholic faith. You know, we know that the Catholic faith is not a monolith by any means, but there are people who think that Catholicism equals being against gay marriage, being against choice and abortion. How would you overcome what maybe fears about what Catholicism means to you?
Yeah, I grew up Catholic. The Catholic faith has played an integral role in my life. And at the same time, I don't think that there's a single person that doesn't have some disagreements with their faith. And so I've also been clear that I'm pro-choice. I recognize that there are people of different faiths in this country, and there are people that choose not to believe, and that our Constitution recognizes the difference between one's faith and the governance of this country.
What would be your number one issue, like day one in office, number one thing you want to focus on as president?
Well, the number one thing that I'm going to do on the afternoon of January 20th, 2021 is sign an executive order recommitting the United States to the Paris Climate Agreement and the first major piece of legislation that my administration would submit to Congress is on universal health insurance. So those are two things that I would focus on right away. I actually believe that one of the lessons of 1993 and 1994, as well as 2009 and 2010, is that when a Democratic president has the opportunity to, with a Democratic Congress, that you shouldn't wait to push significant legislation, whether it's health care, immigration reform, other measures.
Julian Castro, former mayor of San Antonio, also former secretary of Housing and Urban Development under President Obama, current candidate to be the Democratic Party's nominee for president of the United States. Julian, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks a lot, Robin.
Gordon Hempton has dedicated his life to recording the sounds of the natural world, from the rainforest of Hawaii to the vast dry prairies of North America. But then one day he woke up to silence. Gordon Hempton is losing his hearing, and now he's on a mission to help people be better listeners. Ashley Ahern has his story.
Listening to nature is a spiritual experience for Gordon Hempton. To make one of his recordings, he sits for hours, perfectly still, in an almost meditative state.
I was recently in a very remote part of the Amazon rainforest, and I just was taking it all in, and I begin to hear the insect patterns and how they are rhythmic, and each rhythm is a different insect, especially as the light weakens and we make the transition from day into evening and night. Oh my God, and I realized this is the sound of the spinning earth, that this is actually like a huge clock. Now I'm listening not just to the seconds, but to the milliseconds.
Gordon says that when we listen to nature uninterrupted, we start to hear a bioacoustic system at work, a web of birds and insects and predators and prey, all talking to one another, like a kind of sonic social network, whether it's in the Amazon rainforest or Hempton's backyard, Washington State's Olympic Peninsula.
If the Pacific wren is singing, it will be singing in its own bandwidth and niche in such a way that it's recognizable to other Pacific wrens. And the thrushes, for example, will be singing something entirely different.
But so many of us take our sense of hearing for granted. Gordon doesn't have that privilege anymore.
The first time I lost my hearing, I was laying in bed and I had my bedroom window open because I love sleeping where I can listen to the outside and know where I am. And I woke up one night and I was hearing vroom, 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 vroom.
Gordon thought it was a large tanker ship motoring by off the coast, but the sound was actually his own heart beating. Within a matter of days, his hearing was gone. He figured it was the flu and that it would pass and his hearing would come back. But as the months went by and doctor after doctor couldn't diagnose the problem, Gordon started to lose hope.
It was very discouraging. It took me really is hard. I was put out of work. I was cut off from everything and everyone I loved, including the voices of my children.
A year and a half went by, and Gordon was grasping for answers. He started sinking into depression. But then, out of the blue, he heard this.
One night, next to the wood fire, I heard the fire crackle perfectly in such detail. The cellulose chambers collapsing in those high frequencies, and it lasted like 5 seconds and then disappeared. That's all I needed. I knew it was possible to hear again.
As his hearing slowly came back, Gordon threw himself wholeheartedly into his work. He started an organization to advocate against noise pollution in national parks and wild places. He gave talks and wrote articles. But then, 4 years ago, Gordon's ears started to fail him once again. He still doesn't have a diagnosis for his hearing loss, but he does have a heightened sense of urgency to bring his recordings to the greatest number of people while he still can. He's hired two young assistants with healthy ears to help him catalog the thousands of recordings he's made over his career. And together, they created a special series of Gordon's favorite recordings, from the grasslands of Canada to the rainforests of Hawaii to rivers in South America.
I cannot hear most birds. I can't hear any insects, but I can remember. And that has been key to the production of these podcasts, is that the original experience of being on location was so exciting for me that I would never forget, and it's so easy for me to share.
The art of truly listening to nature gets schooled out of most of us from an early age. But Gordon says it's a skill that we can relearn, and he wants to help us do it. For Here and Now, I'm Ashley Ahern.
Nice to hear all of those sounds. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young, and we are grateful for our hearing. Here and Now.